The Founding Fathers, American Revolution, our Constitution, our history, America. Thanks so much for tuning in as we discuss the people, places, events, and battles that turned 13 separate colonies into the greatest nation on earth, the United States.
Welcome back, Patriots. I am your host, Ron Kern, and I want to thank you for allowing me to share my passion with you of the American Revolution and our country's history with you. It has been a hot minute since my bride has joined us, but today she is here, and she's going to be providing additional input as well as giving your ears a break in not having to listen to just my voice. The last episode that we did together was well received, so welcome, Lisa.
Hello, glad to be here.
Yes, those of you that don't know, she's been kind of laid up. She does some equine therapy and was kicked by a horse a month ago, which wasn't good.
Got a little broken bones.
Her left forearm, both of those bones, what are those called? Radius and
ulna.
Both of them were broken, so she has been teaching me how to do laundry, and I've been waiting on her hand and foot, right?
Yes.
All right. I paid her $20. You can't see that because this is audio only, but it's pretty cool when you have two different points of view, so I'm glad that she's here. Our last chronological episode discussed was one of my favorites, actually, the March 2 and the Battle of Quebec, which was back in episode number 29. I'm excited to continue the timeline with today's show, as it's been a little bit. In this episode, we are going to talk about an expedition that was absolutely remarkable. It was also critically important to the early part of the war, and we're going to discuss its impact, key players involved, and several other interesting stories and tidbits of information that I think you're going to find pretty darn interesting. And there's so much to this person, his life, and accomplishments. So with that, let's get started. At about the same time as the march to Quebec was taking place, this expedition that I'm going to cover today was also taking place, and I'm referring to what is now called the Knox Expedition. One of the most unlikely heroes of the Revolution, Henry Knox is truly understated and not talked about enough, in my opinion. Before we delve into the expedition itself, I think it's wise to give you some background on Henry himself, as it's not only going to be important for you to understand the full story and his background, it's quite interesting. And Lisa, why don't you tell everyone about his early years?
Alrighty. Henry Knox was born in Boston in 1750, and he was the seventh child out of 10 to William and Mary Knox.
10 kids?
10 kids.
That's how many we had, right?
I think several of them didn't survive.
Yeah.
So, which was common back in those days.
Yeah, for sure. But 10?
A lot.
That's a lot. All right, anyway.
Henry's father was a shipmaster, and he was on the sea a lot, conducting trade to many areas, but primarily in the West Indies. That's the Caribbean, right?
Yep.
So some say that William left and stayed in the West Indies due to financial issues and then passed away at the age of 50. However, other reports say he died as he and the ship that he was on were lost at sea. We couldn't find any concrete proof of which story is the truth, but regardless, this left Henry without a father at a young age. Not having a father brings on many challenges, and he wasn't the only one growing up during this time without a father. George Washington's father died also when George was just 11 years old, and I believe Nathaniel Greene's father died early as well, along with other well-known and founding father types.
It's kind of amazing if you think about, I mean, today, right? People that grow up without fathers, not all, but a lot of times it's quite difficult and there's issues as they, you know, grow up and turn into adults. And I was kind of surprised. I knew, obviously, George Washington, his dad died early, but I didn't know about Nathaniel Greene and a couple others. I think I remember Knox, but how come back then these amazing accomplishments and people, they didn't have father figures, and look what they did. And maybe it's just because we're only looking at a select few, maybe out of the 2 million population at the time in the 13 colonies, maybe there was a lot more that had issues. But I just think it's weird or odd that so many success stories came from our founding fathers that didn't have a father figure to look up to, you know?
I think there was more collaboration between families. There was other family members that could step in as a father figure, maybe, as well as, like in the case of Henry Knox and some others, they had other people around them, either in the military or in the community, that stepped in and kind of stepped up to that role for them and had mentors a lot more than people do now.
Oh, that's a good point, because typically many families, you know, once a couple had kids and the kids had their kids, they were within a 5 to 15 mile radius. So they had a lot of family resources. And now, I mean, we're lucky and blessed because our kids live close to us and our granddaughter lives obviously close to us. And but, you know, there's a lot of people now, it's like, where's your grandparents? Oh, they're in New York. Oh, where's your other set of grandparents? So they're in Washington. Where do you live? I live in Kansas. I mean, so it's really spread out. So mm-hmm. That's a good point. Mm-hmm.
So Henry, now fatherless, had to learn how to help his family the best he could, as he was the oldest male in the family after his father died. And by oldest in the family, I mean he was only 9 years old, so that's pretty young.
Nine.
He left school and started working as a clerk in a Boston bookstore. Can you imagine quitting school and taking a job at the age of 9? Children did work a lot younger back in those days.
Nine,
yes.
I can't even comprehend 9. Was I still in diapers at 9? I don't know. I'm probably not too far off of going back into diapers. But yeah, at 9 years old, that's crazy. You know, it's important to me, and maybe it's a pet peeve, but I want to note that he wasn't always what you see in paintings of Henry Knox. Like, you know, you Google Henry Knox, you're going to bring up pictures. And many, many podcasts that I've listened to, articles that I've read, books that I've read, always seem to state that he was a portly, large, big man standing 6 foot tall and over 250 pounds. And some even refer to him as just fat. I think that's rude, but he really was a massive human being, for sure, when you compared him to others of the time. I mean, but I want you to realize how he and people looked in the paintings, which was as an adult and after the war or during the war, doesn't mean that he was always like that. It's interesting that when we see or hear of a person, we picture them, maybe a certain event or a time frame, we picture them and that we assume that that's the way they've been forever.
I think that's really true with people like Martha Washington. All the pictures that we see of Martha Washington are when she was old and, you know, looked like an old grandma with white hair and she was heavy set. And she was actually a lovely woman.
Well, and that was, you know, I was going to mention that, but you beat me to the punch. But, you know, you picture Martha Washington. If I say Martha Washington, or Lisa just did, you probably already had a vision of what she looked like. Short, gray hair, plump. She was a looker. Martha Washington Young was one of the most attractive women in the colonies, and probably it didn't hurt that she was the richest, you know, woman in all of the colonies. So, but yeah, I mean, you say George Washington, many of you likely pictured older man, and what George Washington looked like? Well, he looked like what he's on the dollar bill. He was amazing, young, strong. In fact, he was so strong back then. I mean, they had contests and he would always win. But anyway, you know, Martha Washington too, she was quite the looker. And just remember, we only have paintings of people during the Revolution. So we don't have any social media accounts to peruse. We don't have any baby pictures to ponder and remember. And I guess I say all of this because I think very highly of Henry Knox. And almost everything I read or hear about him is how big and fat he was. He was so much more than that, which is the point I'm trying to get across now. And so I digress and I will step off of my soapbox now. You know, in fact, when Henry was young, like many young kids, especially in Boston at the time, they were involved in gangs and gangs fight. He became one of the absolute most feared fighters in the entire city of Boston. and he won almost all of his fist fights. In short, he was just a heck of a fighter and boxed his way to basically nobody was going to mess with him going forward. In fact, nobody would challenge him. He was just that good. So at a super young age, he was working in the bookstore to help his mother pay bills at 9. That's just insane. The owner of the bookstore was Nicholas Bowes, or Bowes, I'm not sure. I'm going to go with Bowes. That just sounds better. So Nicholas Bowes owned a bookstore, and he really liked Knox. And I don't want to say he took on the role of a full-fledged father figure, but he was there for Henry whenever he needed something, and he was also very supportive of Knox. And he really encouraged Henry to read as much as possible.
We wondered if Mr. Bowes had any knowledge of just what kind of a positive impact he made for Henry, which would then in turn be so important for the Revolutionary War. Well, we had to do some digging, but found out that he unfortunately passed away in 1777. So he died prior to seeing all that Knox would accomplish, and prior to America becoming its own country. A sad deal for sure, but sometimes the ripples and effect you have on someone's life through your own actions could be so much more than you think. Although you, and in this case Mr. Bowes, may not always see the outcome of your actions, never forget your acts of kindness, support, encouragement, or help may end up being invaluable to someone and could be extremely valuable and beneficial.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And coming from a mother, right, that's even more impactful. But it was kind of sad. I was hoping this guy lived till 1780 and all of that. But unfortunately, he passed away just a year after we declared independence. So good stuff. Good notes of encouragement there. So,
at any rate, one of the biggest gifts his boss gave Henry was allowing him to take home any book from the store that he wanted. This is really important because books were extraordinarily expensive in those days. It took a lot to produce them, and so just anybody couldn't have a whole library of books. So being able to have access to all those books at the bookstore was really important for Henry Knox, and he loved to read.
Yeah, and just to chime in, you didn't own books if you weren't rich. Books were so important that during the Stamp Act, and you'll have to go way back to episode, like, I don't know, 4, 5, or 6, something like that, where I talk about the Stamp Act, where they put a tax on paper and everything else. They never would put a tax, or the Stamp Act did not include books. So even British knew how important books were. And let's talk about books, right? Now we can type something up or have AI type something up. Throw it in Amazon Kindle and it can publish on demand, and there you go, I'm an author. Back then, it had to be typeset, which is a super slow process. It had to be copied, which is not a Xerox. It was excessively painstaking and time-consuming. And then, if you really wanted it to last, you would have to find a bookbinder. And depending on what material, oftentimes leather, that was really, really expensive. So when you hear, or if you have heard of George Washington's library, Thomas Jefferson's massive library, which eventually after his death started the what?
Library of Congress.
Yes, his collection started the Library of Congress. So books were incredible. That is really how most people gain their knowledge. And I highly encourage you to pick up a real physical book. Once you own that book, it can't be tampered with, it can't be changed, edited, and reprinted, right? So books are critical. And back then, like Lisa was saying, that's where you get all your data and your knowledge. Yes, some people went to school, but they just, books were the thing. Books were it.
Yeah, and a lot of the most well-educated people read so many books we can't even comprehend.
Yeah.
At this time, people don't read as much as they used to, but that's really how they learned a tremendous amount of thing. So this opened up Henry to so much of the world. He was an avid reader, consuming book after book, year after year. He read so much that he taught himself the French language. He studied philosophy and had a leaning toward ancient warriors and famous battles in any era or war he could read about. He actually had this fascination topic of interest of his about studying battles and wars and military tactics, battlefield plans, weaponry, basically how to fight and win wars. And that would no doubt come in handy for him and the American cause years later.
Yeah, it would come in real handy. On March 5th of 1770, which is actually just a few days ago, March 5th, Henry was a witness to the Boston Massacre. You'll have to go back, but I do an episode on the Boston Massacre if you want to learn about that. But looking back at his life, it is unbelievable on how many times he was present or involved with on so many huge historical moments, like the Boston Massacre. During the Boston Massacre, he actually was a young kid, but he ran up and tried to get the British soldiers to return to their barracks. But as history tells us, he was not successful in that attempt. He also testified at the trial where none other than John Adams was the defense attorney for the British soldiers. So when I was reading this book, I was like, he was there? And then, oh, he was there? What? He did what? And I'm like, is this real? Why does not everybody know about Henry Knox? I knew a lot. I mean, Lisa and I both study and we knew a lot, but I was pretty shocked because I didn't know it all, obviously. So, and so in 1771, Knox decided to open his very own bookstore. He's going to be a little entrepreneur in Boston, and he called it the London Bookstore. He procured some of the best books and other items to sell in the city, and his bookstore became really popular, especially to the aristocrats and high society people. It was basically a hangout for the rich, in other words. And not forgetting that his childhood interest in battles and wars, he stocked his shelves full of these kind of books, which brought in what? A lot of
soldiers.
Soldiers would visit too. And Knox would strike up a conversation with any of them that would listen. He would ask them questions, and he always was trying to seek information. And if you're trying to learn the best ways to be a soldier, a good thought is maybe talk to a soldier. So he was always learning, whether it was talking with people, gaining their experience through their actual life experience or books. And this, coupled with everything that he read, just added to his knowledge. And he was really gaining a great grasp of the art of war.
Henry's bookstore was quite successful until the boycott of British goods was imposed, making it impossible for him to keep current and fresh books and items in his store. And once sold, he couldn't replenish them. So they were putting a boycott on importing British goods.
Anything, right? Anything from Britain, right?
Anything from Britain.
Yes. God, that would not be good. You have a successful bookstore, yeah, and you're kicking tail and making sales, and you're living your dream, and then you can't get any more books or anything else for that matter.
So his sales started to suffer. Bookstores back then, they didn't just sell books. They offered book binding, like Ron was mentioning, stationery, medicines, maps, and even scientific instruments. These bookstores became a place to meet, discuss life and philosophy. So they weren't just a place to walk in and buy a book and leave. Like we talked about earlier, the aristocrats would come in there, the high society people would come in there, and they would have discussions and philosophical ideas and, you know, just kind of interact with each other in that way.
We're on a roll and having fun here with Lisa, but we need to take a quick break and hear from one of our sponsors.
So getting back to our chronology here, just shy of his 23rd birthday, Henry Knox was hunting and he had an accident, which resulted in losing two of his fingers on his left hand. He quickly bandaged it and later had surgery, but he would never have a normal hand again. He was really self-conscious of this, and even in paintings you can see a scarf or a wrap around his hand, or his hand is in the inside of the coat of his military uniform, or not in the painting at all.
Yeah, it's bizarre to me, like, okay, we're 200 almost 50 years later, you know, knowing what he did, and you soon will know what he did and all that he accomplished by listening here, but 250, I could care less if he was missing his whole hand. He was just amazing in what he did, but they were super self-conscious. I mean, and George Washington, he was conscious of what?
His teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, these people were not just marble figures and statues. They were human beings with fears, doubts, and real life issues and concerns. So It's just funny that he was so... I mean, there's many people that wrote, and he's like, I never saw his left hand. He kept his hand behind his back. I mean, I'm like, he just did not want people to, I guess, point and look. And it happened when he was, you know, young, but he did not want people to see his hand. So I just thought that was interesting.
So many people say that Knox was involved with the Sons of Liberty, but he wasn't obvious about it. He wasn't real outspoken about it. But here we go with another historical moment where he was present. So one of the most famous historical events that the Sons of Liberty instigated, and that's the Boston Tea Party, which took place in 1773. It isn't clear that he was on the ship tossing the tea overboard personally. Maybe he was on guard duty and wouldn't let the ship Dartmouth unload the tea. Either way, he was present during this event as well. And having read many books and studying Knox at length, I like to believe he took part in the tea-tossing party.
I do too. Right on.
But I don't have any actual documents or statements from the time to verify this. So you can decide for yourself if you think he did or didn't participate in the actual destruction of the tea. But either way, he was there. He was involved in some way.
Yeah, I'm going to just mentally say he was on board, but factually, I don't think he was. Because every actual document and primary source that I could find clearly states that he was on guard duty, not allowing them to unload the tea. But who's to say? He's standing guard. It wouldn't take but 3 minutes to jump aboard and throw some tea out. So we don't want to paint an improper or unfactual deal. So you just have to decide for yourself. But either way, yet again, there he was at another big event, right? The Boston Massacre, the Boston Tea Party, everybody should know and has heard about that. So near the end of this show, we're going to talk about lesser known, fun, or interesting facts, which is a section I do on our podcast. And there I'm going to list off all of the events that Knox was involved or present at. And I'll let you know the list is crazy, because there's lots of them, and I would be shocked if you didn't know every single one. So it was pretty amazing. So what happened after the Boston Tea Party in 1773? Did he meet and fall in love with somebody like I did 32 and a half years ago with you?
Yeah, so actually...
Has it really been that long?
It has, yeah.
Folks, I'm so glad you can just hear, because I'm like an old, decrepit man right now with gray hair. And no, actually, I look like a George Clooney, Brad Pitt mix, right?
Right.
Oh, thank you. Yes. All right. So what happened after the Boston Tea Party?
So he fell in love with and married a woman named Lucy Flucker. And Lucy's father was a Boston loyalist. So, oops, that's probably not Daddy's favorite person. He was really obvious in supporting Britain and the king. And Lucy's brother was in the British Army. And they did all they could to get Henry Knox to join the British side. But Knox refused. He was definitely on the Patriot side. And Lucy's father refused to honor or support his daughter in marriage. But she was her own woman, and she decided to marry him anyway.
Because she chose Henry Knox, she lost the rich, pampered life that her family provided. I just think it's incredible that she was willing to do that. And yes, obviously they were in love. They stayed married up until Knox passed away, actually, which we'll get into the odd and weird death that he had. But I mean, she walked away from it all. She walked away from privilege. She walked away from security. She walked away from everything. And that tells you just how much that she loved him. And unlike many other generals, especially on the British side, that would go find women of the night and have their affairs constantly, Knox never did. And George Washington never did. And so they loved each other. And I guess Henry's mother-in-law would be called Mother Flucker. Is that how it worked? I wish that was original. I stole that from Michael Troy, who I've interviewed on this show before. But I just think that's funny. Some pronounce it Fluker, some say Flucker. You pronounced it Lucy Flucker, correct? So that's what we're going to go with.
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, she spent a fair amount of time with him during the war, did she not?
She did.
They wrote a lot of letters back and forth, but I think that she actually came with the army on several instances.
Yes.
So she was not living the high life during those years, let me tell you. Those camp supporting women and wives that came with the camps, they had a hard life. It wasn't easy.
Yeah, and she, and in some of her letters to him, she would, I'll say pout, complain, you know, where are you at? I haven't seen you in weeks, and I gave birth and you weren't there. And I mean, all of this is true, and I'm not downplaying it, but it was a rough go. And yet their connection and love for each other was stronger than being separated. And, you know, Knox being, every day he was out there, someone was trying to kill him. So it was pretty incredible, a relationship that they had. And when the war had its official battles, that being the first battles, the Lexington and Concord in 1775, Henry and his new bride stayed in Boston. No, they actually had to flee. They left Boston quickly, so fast that he left his bookstore with everything in it. And it was eventually looted and damaged, and something that the British Army liked to do. We all hear about how, I'm not saying all British soldiers, but we all hear how sophisticated and polite and the etiquette of, they burned a lot of homes, bridges, outbuildings, hay, they killed animals, and they stole and damaged businesses, especially when they left in a hurry. And they weren't the only ones. So Lisa has something else here.
Yeah, so before they left the city of Boston, it says Lucy sewed his sword into her petticoat.
Say that five times. Lucy
sewed his sword into her petticoat. They were able to pass through the British lines without it being discovered, and he carried that sword with him for the duration of his service in the war.
Wow.
See, I can't imagine carrying
a sword
and, in your petticoat.
Wow, Lisa finds all these fun things. That's cool.
So it's just to review, and this is all in previous episodes too, they were fleeing the city because after Lexington and Concord, the British hightailed it back to Boston and then they occupied the city. And so the British Army was in control of Boston at that time, and many of the Patriots, most of the Patriots, had to escape and evacuate. So they left
him. Yeah, if you were a Patriot or you were kind of in the camp of wanting or gaining independence, Boston was not the place that you wanted to be. So Knox was then put under the command of General Artemas Ward. He doesn't get very much press either, probably because George Washington would eventually replace him as commander-in-chief and general. But Knox directed cannon fire at the Battle of Bunker Hill. Another, right? So we have the Boston Massacre, we have the Boston Tea Party, and now Bunker Hill. All of these I'm sure you've heard of. He was there directing cannon fire at Bunker Hill. So yet another famous event where Knox was not only present watching, he actively participated in it. And when Washington arrived in July of 1775, he met Henry Knox, and the two quickly became pretty well acquainted. And Washington immediately took a liking to Knox and was very impressed with his actions. And Knox was then asked by Washington to join him in several meetings with other generals as the Continental Army continued to be formed.
So yeah, this kind of starts out Knox's artillery career, so to speak, right? This is kind of his first chance to put into action all of that knowledge that he read in books, got put in charge of the artillery and the cannons at Bunker Hill.
Washington had a real good knack of finding people that would eventually excel in the position that he put him in. This, with Knox, was absolutely no exception. He saw in Knox a can-do kind of attitude, a go-getter, somebody that could get the job done regardless of how insane or crazy it is, which we'll get into here momentarily. But Washington did this with who else? Anybody? How about Alexander Hamilton? How about Nathaniel Greene, who had no knowledge except for reading books? Alexander Hamilton had no war experience. Many of these young, Marquis de Lafayette, who also became very good friends. I do a whole episode on him, so make sure you listen to that. But he had a great, that was part of his Washington's leadership. He could find, I'll say, diamonds in the rough and put them in positions where that where they were going to succeed and excel. And Washington, although I would agree he was not the the most brilliant military tactician and battlefield commander, his leadership is second to none. And it's just, here's another example. And one of the first actual examples, and he saw in Henry Knox. Henry Knox had no war experience.
He was a bookseller.
He sold books in Boston. He just recently got married. He wasn't wealthy. You know, all of the things that you could write down on the do not hire this person, that would have been Knox. But Washington could always see the genius of people. And trust me, he could see the non-genius and would get rid of people quickly as well. So it wasn't like he was just looking at people and being optimistic. Oh, I think you could. He knew. So that was one of Washington's geniuses as well. So Knox didn't even have a commission or a rank in the army, and none other than John Adams. John Adams was, he's amazing too. He worked really hard to get Knox a commission. But Knox, being a entrepreneurial and a go-getter type guy, he also wrote letters in support of him getting a commission as well. And with the siege of Boston fully in effect, that is, like Lisa said, the British Army controlling the city completely, something had to be done, or quite possibly, and I'm not trying to make this anticlimactic, I mean, literally the revolution could end right then and there.
Yeah, so it took until November 17th, 1775, Washington appointed him as the colonel of the Continental Regiment of Artillery. So he became a colonel in November of 1775, and he finally got his rank that he was looking for.
Dun-ta-da! Finally. It doesn't take long. Congress moved as fast back then as they do today. And I'm not being political. I don't do that on this show, but you can see how slow Congress is to do anything. It hasn't changed since Congress was formed, the First Continental Congress and the Second Continental Congress. Hey, both of which I have episodes on each one of those Congresses. Of course I do. So Henry Knox is like, you know what? Or George Washington was like, you know what? We're pretty much done unless something drastic happens. So,
and as much as he was the colonel of this artillery regiment, they didn't have a lot of artillery to use at the time. And so Knox came up with this great idea about Fort Ticonderoga. And you may have heard of Fort Ticonderoga in terms of an earlier overtaking that happened with none other than, of course, Benedict Arnold.
And Ethan Allen.
And Ethan Allen, who came up to Fort Ticonderoga and surprised the very loosely held British troops there and took over the fort. So it had been sitting with all this captured artillery up at Fort Ticonderoga for quite some time.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that came into Knox's brain. He says, you know what? We have artillery. I just have to go get it.
Yeah, that's easy.
Just
go get it. I mean, it's it's handy. It's light. It's lightweight. You can put it in the back of your pocket. So Knox says, like Lisa just mentioned, hey, G-Dub. He probably didn't call him G-Dub like I do. But he said, I'll go get it. And there were 60 tons of cannons and artillery available for the grabbing. But here's the problem. It was winter. It was cold. The lakes and rivers were frozen.
Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes. Huge mountains that they would have to traverse. But thankfully, the journey was just a short 300 miles. 300 miles.
Of wilderness.
So we are, I'm sure you know this because I've mentioned it a couple times, but we're located in southern Idaho. 300 miles north of us, we would reach the border of Canada. So we're 300 miles. You know how far that is, but you need to understand that it's not on a freeway. It's through uncharted. There wasn't even roads. There was no roads. There might have been a path, but the path wasn't even a path. It was ridiculous. It's like going to the middle of a forest and trying to figure it out.
In the snow.
So what could possibly go wrong in trying to bring back 120,000 pounds of super heavy artillery items, cannons, mortars, during the winter with no roads, and we're only going to use some horse, some oxen, and ropes and pulleys?
If you haven't picked up on it yet, Knox is quite a go-getter and an entrepreneur. He started his own bookstore, he married a daughter of a loyalist when her father and everyone else tried to stop it, he directed the cannon at Bunker Hill, and now he was offering to do something that he, nor anyone else for that matter, had ever done.
Not even close. Nobody had ever attempted anything like this before.
And by the way, they haven't really accomplished anything that major since either.
No, they have not. Now, granted, you know, now we have helicopters and things like that, but we'll get into what people say about this expedition here a little bit later. This is a pretty good place in the episode to press pause on, and we are going to consider this episode a part one. Part two will be coming out soon, so you definitely want to check back and listen to part two. We're going to go over the actual expedition, read some of his very insightful and meaningful diary entries, and then explain what happens if he can get back to Boston and what happens there. So make sure you subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already, so you get notified when part two of the Knox Expedition is published.
Thanks for listening, and hope that you tune in next time with us here at the Patriot Power Podcast. Make sure that you hit subscribe so you'll get notified when our new episodes are available for you. And we hope that you check out our websites, which include our show notes, links, documents, and more at patriotpowerpodcast.com or ilovegeorgewashington.com. Until next time, hope that you and your family have a blessed week. And remember, be safe and tell a veteran thanks for their service.